Okay. Thank you, Jim. I'd like to begin by thanking the organizers for giving me the opportunity to speak here. So I will be telling you guys about Wilson lines and entanglement entropy in higher spin gravity. And this is work that I did in collaboration with Martin M and Alejandro Castro. Pretty much everything I'm going to say can be found in this preprint. So before I start, if you look at the title, it kind of looks like there are three random ideas here that do not obviously have anything to do with each other. So I think this isn't true. I think that there are very good reasons why you want to study entanglement entropy in higher spin gravity. And if you decide you want to do that, you are led to Wilson lines. And the story I'm going to tell you is how that works. Okay. So I'm going to begin in a sort of unnecessarily vague way. So what is geometry? Okay. So we all know what geometry is. Geometry is curvature and manifolds and things like that. But what's sort of fun is that nowadays, in the era of ADS CFT, the question, what is geometry, actually has many answers. It has more than one answer. So in addition to being geometry and curvature and manifolds and Riemann tensors, it turns out that geometry is often the answer to a very different question. Because certain gravitational theories on anti-de Sitter space, so theories of gravity, theories of geometry, are actually dual to conformal field theories that live in one lower dimension. And so that means that sometimes if you have quarks and gluons that are interacting in just the right way, geometry is an emergent phenomenon that describes that dynamics. It's an emergent phenomenon that really comes from things that don't look like they have anything geometric going on. And so this is a fun new thing that we have because of ADS CFT. And also the way I've said it is kind of vague and fluffy. And so it's of interest to try to make this idea, or these notions of how geometry might emerge from different degrees of freedom, it's interesting to try to make that notion more precise. So how do we do that? How does one go about doing this? So it turns out there are some clues on how you might do this. Okay. So for the next couple of slides, let's forget about holography for a second, and I'm just going to review the idea of entanglement entropy. So I think everyone here knows about this already, so I'm just going to be a little bit quick. So consider your favorite quantum field theory living in D dimensions and take a spatial region A in that quantum field theory. And consider it in some state. Take your favorite state. Now consider the density matrix you get if you trace out everything that's not in A. You get some reduced density matrix rho sub A. That describes only things that are happening in here. Only degrees of freedom associated with A. You have thrown out everything else. The entanglement entropy associated with this region A is a number which is just the ordinary von Neumann entropy of that density matrix. So negative trace rho A log rho A. Okay, this is the definition of the entanglement entropy. Okay, so this is a fun object to consider. Why is it fun? What does it measure? So if you started in a pure state, the entanglement entropy, this number, measures the quantum entanglement between region A and everything outside region A. That's why it's called the entanglement entropy. And in a normal local quantum field theory, if you take, say, the vacuum of a local quantum field theory, the dominant contribution to this comes from correlations of things that are right inside A and right outside A. So the dominant contribution comes from there, basically UV divergent things coming from very, very short range correlations. And thus, in quantum field theories in sufficiently high dimension, this answer scales like the area of the boundary of A. Okay. This is called an area law. So this area...
Local quantum field theories?
I'm going to talk about local quantum field theories, yeah.
We're hearing these days from some people about non-local.
Right.
Would then the entropy be concentrated? Or the correlations really concentrated near the boundary?
I really don't know, actually. I haven't thought about that at all. I'm not sure. It's a good question. Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not really sure. Okay. There have been some recent studies of entanglement entropy in non-commutative field theories. Some studies just came out recently. I don't really remember what they find, but I think they do say the UV structure is modified. So it's quite possible there is a precise answer to your question that I just do not know. Okay. So this area law breaks down in 1 plus 1 conformal field theories, for example. And so what happens there is that if you have, of course, in 1 plus 1 CFT, your region A is just an interval. And if you had a strict area law, then the entanglement entropy wouldn't care about the length of the interval, because the area is always just two points in this sense. But that's not true. If you make your interval bigger, the entanglement entropy does get bigger. And this is a classic and beautiful result from 2D CFT, derived by famous people. The entanglement entropy is, in this case, in the vacuum of a 2D CFT, is C over 3 log L, where C is the central charge, and L is the length of the interval. Okay. This is a classic result. Okay, so that's entanglement entropy in pure states. How about in mixed states? So take your favorite mixed state. So for example, consider the thermal state, which is my favorite mixed state, and consider a region A in the thermal state. Now, this guy already had some ordinary classical entropy associated with it. And in that case, the entanglement entropy basically just measures the ordinary entropy contained in A. If you take your region to be big enough, the dominant piece will come from the volume of A, and it'll just measure the ordinary entropy. This is what you get. SA goes in a translationally invariant mixed state. The entanglement entropy goes like the volume of A times the entropy density in that state. Okay? And this should seem like a reasonable result. So if you're in a 2D CFT at finite temperature, you can, again, actually exactly calculate the entanglement entropy for an interval if the system is infinite at a finite temperature, and you get this formula. So the reason you can do this is because in 2D, the cylinder is conformal to the plane, and so anything you can do on the plane, like the previous result, you can probably do on the Euclidean cylinder, which is the system at finite temperature. So you can get an exact result for the entanglement entropy. The precise formula is not that important, but you should note that at large L, so when this guy becomes very big, the sinh becomes an exponential, the log eats the exponential, and you just get something scaling linearly with L, which is just what you expect from this form. Yeah? Okay, good. So this is how things work in field theory. These are all very standard results. Now, let's turn back to holography. So consider a quantum field theory with a normal gravity dual. Okay. So by normal, I mean it's dual to like Einstein gravity with maybe some higher derivative fraction or something like that. But you know, not even those, just normal gravity, meaning just Einstein gravity. Okay. Then what you find is that you have a field theory now. The field theory now lives on the boundary. And your region A is some region on the boundary. There's a very, very, very nice formula for the entanglement entropy computed from the gravity theory. Ryu and Takinagi proposed that the entanglement entropy is equal to the area of the bulk minimal surface. So find the minimal surface in the bulk, make it end on the boundary at the boundary of A. The entanglement entropy is equal to the area of that bulk minimal surface that ends on A. So this is this famous Ryu Takinagi entanglement entropy formula. Okay? It's very simple. It's really very simple. So let me just brief.
Here's a question. Yeah. I'm somewhat confused by essence. If you take something like confining vacuum.
Yeah.
And you take a really, really, really big area.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see that entanglement entropy is getting like the area, but rather like the volume, because you imagine that the surface stays
at
the bottom of the.
Good. So actually, that's not what happened. So this is fun. So let's talk about it. So let's take the ADS soliton, for example. That's my favorite. It's the simplest confining theory. So there you have a compact circle. You have an S1, and you have some other field theory, some other directions. So in the ADS soliton, you have an S1, and you have 2+1 field theory directions as well, say.
Okay.
Now what you do is the S1 shrinks in the bulk. That's because it's a confining vacuum. You should take your Ryu Takinagi surface to wrap this S1. Okay. So if you begin to spread it out large, what happens is the S1 shrinks to zero, and it sort of becomes, it doesn't actually cling to the bottom, rather it shrinks to zero at the boundary of the region, if that made sense. So the surface that you want is you have A, it comes down here, and at all points here, the S1 shrinks to zero size. It does not fill in the interior.
Someplace behind that box. I personally had it installed.
There we go. Okay. So the S1 shrinks to zero here. It doesn't fill in. The interior of this is not filled in. Rather, the S1 shrinks to zero size here. And so that's how the confining vacuum works out. Good. Okay. So you can put this through a lot of checks, and it seems to do very well in cases you can prove it. It does things very well. Okay. Okay, good. So let me just briefly remind everyone how to derive the previous results from the previous slide in this using this proper distance formula. Okay. So for example, take pure ADS in the vacuum. Okay, so that's ADS in an infinite the CFT is on a line at zero temperature. This is dual to ADS3 in Poincaré coordinates. So now your minimal surface is just a spatial geodesic if you're in ADS3. So you want to find the geodesic that ends on the boundary. If you do this, then you find that the length of this geodesic grows like the log of the length on the boundary. And the reason why it grows like the log is just that as you make it bigger, it can dip deeper down into the interior. ADS is smaller in the interior, and so it doesn't grow that quickly. It grows like log L. Okay. Now, on the other hand, if you're in a thermal state, then you have a black hole horizon here in the inside. Now, if you extend this guy larger and larger, what you find is that it can't dip down arbitrarily far. Rather, it stops and hugs the horizon. And because it hugs the horizon, as you make it larger and larger, the entanglement entropy scales linearly with L, and not like some other power. It scales. It just measures the length of the horizon over here. And you can see it's basically just measuring the black hole entropy. Okay? This is as you expect it to do from the previous considerations. So in 1 plus 1 dimensions, you can, of course, compute everything exactly, and everything precisely agrees with what you expect from the CFT. So that's fine. Now, here are some thoughts about this formula. The Ryu-Takinagi formula provides a direct connection between two things that are very, very simple, very primitive on the two sides of the duality. On the field theory side, you only really need the notion of a Hilbert space and the idea that things can be entangled with each other. It's very, very primitive data on the field theory side. Similarly, on the gravity side, it's again something very simple. It's a surface, it's an area. It's a very primitive idea. And it's very nice that two such primitive things are related by this duality. It did not need to be the case, and it's sort of very pleasant that this worked out. And so, you know, if you want, there's some sense in which you can imagine building a dual geometry, building the gravity dual from the entanglement pattern in the boundary theory. If you knew how everything was entangled, maybe you could figure out how those correlations worked and understand the full geometry in full detail. And people have been trying to make this explicit recently. You can try to do this. So what I'd like to do here is actually extend these ideas of entanglement entropy to situations where the notion of geometry in the bulk is less clear, where this side of the duality is a little bit messed up. Okay? So I have some particular theories in mind. Recently, there's been a lot of study of theories of higher spin gravity. Okay? So these are some of the people who wrote some of the foundational papers, but there's been a lot of work on this recently. And so let me just tell everyone exactly what these theories are. So the graviton is a spin 2 field in the bulk. These theories contain massless higher spin fields as well, spin 3, spin 4, blah, blah, blah. Often they contain infinitely many massless fields in the bulk. Okay? And so just as string theory in the bulk is dual to gauge theory on the boundary, higher spin theories in the bulk are thought to be dual to vector-like field theories on the boundary. So not gauge theories, but vector-like field theories. For example, the ON model in 3 dimensions is dual to a certain one of these theories in ADS4. So there's many, many fields in most cases. I'm going to be working for the rest of this talk in 3 bulk dimensions, where life is a little bit simpler because you can truncate yourself at any integer n. You can say, I want, for example, a spin 2 field, a spin 3 field, a spin 4 field, and nothing else. And you can stop there. So that's what I'm going to do for the rest of this talk because it'll make life a lot easier, as you'll see. Okay, so these are interesting theories to study. And the thing that I find particularly interesting about them is that they have a really, really large gauge redundancy in the bulk. Okay? These gauge redundancies act non-trivially on the metric in that they don't leave the geometry invariant. They rotate the geometry into the higher spin fields in a very complicated way. So for example, there are black hole solutions to this theory. You can write down a black hole solution, and it'll have a horizon and things like that. And then you can do a gauge transformation. And after doing this gauge transformation, you'll end up with something that looks like a traversable wormhole. The event horizon will be gone, and you can go back and forth between the two sides. Even though these two things are supposed to describe the same physics, they describe the same field theory state. Okay? And so people have worked this out quite explicitly. So this is very confusing. It's very confusing. What this is telling us is that in these theories, the usual way in which we organize our thinking about geometry is not correct. It is broken down, and it's not even gauge invariant anymore. We need some sort of new organizing principle to understand how to think about the fields and how they're organized in the bulk. Geometry must be replaced by something different. So what could that be? Well, these theories are still dual to CFTs with a well-defined notion of entanglement. So if you want to now compute the entanglement entropy of an interval, the right thing is no longer going to be a spatial geodesic. That can't be right because it's not even gauge invariant anymore. But the question now is, can we find a bulk object that correctly calculates the entanglement entropy? And if we can do this, then I would say this goes some way towards answering the question, what is geometry in higher spin gravity? How should you organize your thinking? And this is the question that I'm going to try to answer for the rest of this talk. This question is harder to answer, but I will answer the first one at least.
So there's not an obvious notion of causal structure in terms of conjugation.
As far as I can tell, there is not. Yeah, as far as I can tell, there isn't. It's very interesting. Yeah, it's kind of hard to drop things into the black holes. Yeah, and you'll see why as I go along.
There might be for objects. You just maybe can't see them in the metric.
That's true. Sorry, it might be for objects. There are sometimes propagating scalar fields, and you can compute propagators and things like this. But it's not easy to tell looking at the metric where the horizon is, for example. Yeah. So it's not that easy, I would say. Good. Other questions? Okay. Good. Okay, so here's another rest of my talk. This was motivation. Now I'm going to tell you first how to think about entanglement entropy in the Chern-Simons formulation of ordinary spin 2 gravity. So the reason why I'm going to do this, so I'm going to basically rewrite things that are kind of familiar in a different language. The reason why I'm going to do this is because I'm going to need that to go to higher spin gravity, which is naturally written in terms of a Chern-Simons theory. And finally, I'll conclude the discussion outlook. So I'll spend most of my time on this, because this is not entirely trivial, but once you understand it, it's pretty easy to see how it works out in higher spin theory. All right, so first up, I'm going to review the Chern-Simons formulation of ADS3 gravity. So pure gravity in three dimensions is kind of simple. It has no bulk propagating degrees of freedom. There is no graviton in 3D. Okay? And in particular, there's still degrees of freedom, but there's no bulk propagating degrees of freedom. So you can write 3D gravity in a way that makes this very obvious. You can write it as a Chern-Simons theory, as a double Chern-Simons theory. And what you do is you just write down this action. There are two gauge fields, A and A bar. Each of them is valued in the group SL2R. So I have two copies of SL2R. And I claim that this action right here is exactly equivalent to the Einstein-Hilbert action. Okay, this has the same information as the normal Einstein action when you write gravity in terms of metric variables. These gauge fields carry the same information as the metric. The reason why we're going to use this is because it generalizes naturally to higher spin theories if you take this 2 and replace it with n. We're not going to do that for a while, but just keep this in mind as I talk about things. If you replace 2 with n, you get a higher spin theory of gravity. So you might not like this action. It doesn't look obviously like gravity. If you want to recover the equations of motion that you're familiar with, you can recover the Wheelbine, the spin connection, and the metric in the following way. The Wheelbine is the difference between A and A bar. The spin connection is the sum. And the metric is contained from the Wheelbine in a normal manner. Okay? But this is just ordinary 3D gravity just written in different variables. So there are no bulk propagating degrees of freedom. There is no graviton in 3D, but there are things. There are fun things to study in 3D gravity anyway on ADS3. And one of those fun things is the BTZ black hole. So I would now like to describe what the BTZ black hole looks like in the Chern-Simons language. So the equations of motion following from Chern-Simons theory are very simple. They just tell you that the bulk connections are flat. Okay, F equals 0. So any flat bulk connection satisfies the equations of motion. So the connections corresponding to the ADS3 vacuum, A is not 0 there. A is different because A is related to the metric in a certain way. So you don't want A to be 0. It's non-zero. But it still has F equals 0 everywhere. So a black hole is a little bit different. A black hole in this language is characterized as the following. It's like a point-like defect. It's sitting here in the bulk. It's a point-like defect with a phi cycle which is non-contractible. But if you Wick rotate to Euclidean time, the Euclidean time cycle is contractible. So if you move around your black hole, then you can tell that it's there because your gauge field will pick up some sort of non-trivial holonomy as you move around. So a black hole in the Chern-Simons language is really just like it's just some defect that carries some non-trivial holonomy. This holonomy is an SL2 matrix. There's some data characterized in an SL2 matrix. And these matrices count the charges, the mass and the angular momentum of the black hole. So one thing that's kind of already clear is that if you look at this, the existence of a horizon or a privileged radius outside this thing is kind of not obvious anymore. Okay? There's a point-like thing with some non-trivial holonomy, but the special radius, which we would have called the horizon, is already kind of obscure. Now, you can, of course, compute the metric and look at the metric and find it if you want. But if you use these variables, it's already making the geometric interpretation a little bit unclear. And this is the problem. And it gets much, much worse in higher spin theory, where you don't really have anything to guide you. Okay, so now I want to reformulate the Ruta-Kanagi prescription in Chern-Simons language. So as we know, the Ruta-Kanagi prescription is equivalent to just asking what is a geodesic. So the question I'd like to answer is, what is a geodesic in the Chern-Simons formulation of 3D gravity? So now a geodesic is some kind of line-like object in the bulk. And so it seems clear that we should think about Wilson lines. It seems clear that Wilson lines will have some role to play in this. They're line-like gauge invariant objects in the bulk. So we should think about Wilson lines. Because our gauge group is SL2, we should think about them in some representation R of SL2. Here's a Wilson line. So really the only question that we could have now is what representation of SL2 should I use? That's the only question that's left.
Wait.
Yeah.
how can you trace when you're going from point A to point B?
You mean this guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, good, very good. So that's a good question. So I'll give it, really in that case, I am probably not taking a trace, but rather an inner product. And if it's a closed loop around the black hole, I'll be taking a specific trace. That's true. So I'll come back to that in a second, actually, in a couple of slides. We can return to that question. That's a good question. If it's an open-ended thing, it's not really, I believe you're right, it's not really a trace, it's more like an inner product between two states. But you'll see it's closely related to the case when you do a loop, when it really is a trace. Good, other questions? Okay, so what representation? So this question, you know, what carries the same information as a geodesic in the Chern-Simons formulation, is very similar to asking, if I have a point particle, some classical point particle, how do I couple it to 3D gravity in the Chern-Simons formulation? So this problem was discussed extensively by people like Witten and Karlip in the late 80s in the context of 3D gravity in flat space. So a lot of what I'm going to say is just taking what they did and generalizing it to ADS gravity. Okay, so how do we do this? So a point particle is some object moving in the bulk that carries some information. In particular, it has mass and spin. This mass and spin tells you how it interacts with the geometry. And so this information, the mass and the spin, must be encoded somehow in this representation under SL2. So when I think about SL2 representations, I first think about sort of simple ones like the vector or the adjoint or something like that. However, those guys are not actually obviously characterized by some parameters that are tunable. They don't really seem to do this thing for me where they have a natural slot where I can stick a mass and a spin. So if you take this out, and there's also another thing that might worry you about them. Since SL2 is non-compact, those representations are necessarily not unitary. And this might or might not bother you. So if you take this idea seriously, this actually rules out the ordinary finite dimensional representations. They don't really seem to be fitting with what I'm trying to do here. Luckily, there are other representations of SL2. So let me remind everyone about the highest weight representations of SL2. So SL2 has three generators, L0, L1, L-1. You can define a representation in the following way. Take a state, call it H, demand it be annihilated by L1. Also given a definite eigenvalue under L0. Now, acting with L-1 an arbitrary number of times, I will generate a tower of states. This tower is going to go on forever. It will never end. The L0 eigenvalue goes up by 1 every time I hit it with L-1. And so they all have different energies, if you will, if I think L0 is an energy. And this is a unitary infinite dimensional representation of SL2. This guy is naturally characterized by a number. The number is the value of the Casimir. So the Casimir, this guy commutes with all the guys in the generator, all the generators of the algebra. And so I can evaluate it anywhere, and it has the same value as on every state in the rep. And it's constant for each rep, so I can evaluate it on the ground state, where I just get that C2, this term goes away. So C2 is H times H minus 1. Okay? So this representation is characterized by a number, and it should sort of feel right. So my claim is the appropriate representation for a massive particle moving in the bulk is the infinite dimensional highest weight representation of SL2 under each copy of the gauge group, under both A and A bar. This is the right representation to use to compute the Wilson loop that I want.
Are these the same representations you get? So if I think of SL2R as the Lorentz group, is this the same sorts of representations I get by looking at wave functions on the hyperboloid?
So let's see. So I believe so. I think a simpler way to see
yes.
this. Yes. So to be more precise, you can think, for example, just think about ADS3 and put a scalar field in there with a certain mass and just quantize that scalar field. And that representation you get are this one, exactly. So that's the question you're asking, I believe. Is that right?
ADS3, that's bigger than the Lorentz.
Good. Sorry, ADS3 is bigger than the...
The symmetry group of ADS3 is bigger.
Yes, right. That's right.
And
that's right.
Group is just around.
That's right. So I think you want to consider, I guess the connection between wave functions and this formalism, I think, is if you quantize the scalar field, the single particle sector of the scalar field on ADS3, which is the same information this guy is carrying, does transform under that representation. And those are wave functions. So I think that's the simplest connection. Regarding the hyperbola, I'm not completely sure, but yeah. Good. Other questions? Okay. So this is the Wilson line. And I claim this is the right one. This is the one you want. This is the one that calculates things you want. So as I mentioned earlier, this rep has two numbers characterizing it, h and h bar. And in the idiocy of T context, it should be clear what these are. This particle moving in the bulk is presumably the quantum of some field. That field is dual to some operator. And h and h bar are the conformable dimensions of the dual operator. Okay. And in the bulk, they can be related in sort of a simple way, just the mass and the spin of the particle. So this is how to talk about classical matter on 88th-degree gravity in the Trin-Simons language. So now my claim is, with this choice of representation, if I now freeze the bulk connection and compute this Wilson line, for example, if I fix these two endpoints here and here, this Wilson line computes the proper distance between the two endpoints. On the other hand, if I loop this guy around a black hole, it'll measure the horizon length and thus the entropy of the black hole. So there's something kind of fun about this, which is that the way I formulated the theory, everything is topological. And so I drew this in a nice way. But in reality, the actual trajectory that the Wilson line takes in the bulk can't matter because the bulk theory is topological. So I can, because I take some crazy wiggly line like this, I should get the same answer. The Wilson line will still report to you the proper distance as measured by the metric associated to the bulk connection. And similarly, I can take some crazy big line around the black hole. It will still actually measure the horizon length of the black hole. Okay.
Is that true only for this particular representation?
No, it should be that. Well, so it will. This form is true only for this particular representation. Okay.
But this independence.
This path independence should be true for any representation, just from, on general grounds. Yeah, that's right. Okay. Good. Other questions? Okay. Okay, because the way in which this happens is actually kind of fun, I'm now going to show you how this geodesic distance comes out. Because remember, the metric is kind of a strange thing in terms of A and A bar. If you just write things down, it's not obvious how the proper distance will emerge from here. So related to this is this question, how do you take a trace in an infinite dimensional representation? I now need to actually do this computation and show you the proper distance comes out. So there's probably math ways to do this where you sum over all the states carefully. But we're going to do this in a physics way. And the physics way to take this trace is to realize that actually we often have infinite dimensional reps all the time in physics. Just they normally come about as the Hilbert spaces of quantum mechanical systems. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to create the states in my rep by inventing an extra quantum mechanical model whose states transform in that representation. Then I'm going to use that quantum mechanical model to take the trace for me. And this is a trick due to Witten. So what is this quantum mechanical model? So consider abstractly the group manifold SL2. Keep it very abstract. Okay, so I have this abstract group manifold here in the corner. And consider a particle U moving in that group manifold. Okay, so it moves through this group manifold. There is a natural action for a particle moving on a group manifold. The action looks like this. This action is very nice because it admits two copies of the SL2 action. The global symmetries are two copies of SL2. One acting from the left and one acting from the right. Okay, it's easy to see this is an invariance of this action. And so this guy has the right global symmetry group. And in fact, you can carefully quantize it and show that the Hilbert space of this model is precisely the highest weight representation that I want. The Casimir must be specified. It appears here in front in the action in this representation. Okay, so that's good. So here are my states. My states live here in this quantum mechanical model. But now I want to use these states to actually compute a trace over a Wilson line. So I need to somehow tell my gauge fields that they should be interacting with this model in some way. So there's really only one way to do this. Remember, I have some path in the bulk, x of s, where my Wilson line is moving. So I have some gauge fields living in the bulk, a and a bar. I can pull those gauge fields back onto this world line and then use them to gauge this global symmetry. So remember, I had a global symmetry, SL2 cross SL2. I can gauge that in a canonical manner by promoting the normal covariant, time derivative into a gauge covariant derivative. So now the SL2 cross SL2 is a gauge symmetry along the world line. But more importantly, now this guy is talking to the gauge fields. And now I claim that if I perform the path integral over U, that will precisely take the trace that I want over the representation. So this does what I wanted to do. The path integral over the field U with the action that I wrote down on the previous slide will compute this Wilson line for me. And so
this is the trick that we're going to use
in the rest of this talk to actually compute this trace.
The gauge field is non-dynamical?
For this talk, I'm going to keep the gauge field frozen, yes. The gauge field represents the geometry. So you should imagine that the geometry is fixed, and I have some probe particle moving on that geometry. That's right. I think you could extend this to actually integrating over the fluctuations as well, but we haven't done it.
Yeah.
Yep.
So if you have a Wilson line in the CFT,
yeah.
You have a geodesic, what's the difference between that normal one and the squiggly one?
They give the same answer, but one of them is much easier to solve for, as I'll show in a second. But they give the same answer in the field theory.
Both they have the same length.
So they both will report back to you the same a number which is equal to the length computed via the metric formulation.
Yeah.
But there's no difference between them.
Is that just a special property of this?
It's because everything is topological in the bulk, so nothing should matter.
Okay.
Nothing should matter. That's right. Okay. They both compute the same number, which is equal to the proper distance with respect to the metric.
Okay, so I was saying is I didn't realize that they have the same proper
length. Yeah. What you should be careful to think about is that the metric is not natural in these variables. The metric is some sort of derived concept. And this is some way to access this derived concept from the gauge fields, A and A bar. Okay? Good question. So for a closed Wilson loop, this is entirely well formulated as a problem. For an open Wilson line, this is related to your question, you have to specify certain boundary conditions at the endpoints for this field U. So that's equivalent to basically taking two states and computing an inner product between them. The right boundary conditions are this. I want the field to go to the identity element on both ends, and I can talk about why I think this is the right boundary condition later, if you want. It's a bit technical. In practice, I'm not going to do the full path integral. I'm going to evaluate this in some sort of saddle point approximation. So I'm going to find a classical solution to these equations of motion and stick that in here, and that will give me an answer. Okay. Yep?
We just computed the trace in the matrix. That would not be proportional to...
Good. So there's in the SL2 theory, there's really only so much data associated with every matrix, right? Because there's, SL2, there's only one number. And so it turns out to be a more complicated function of the proper distance that depends on what... It's not quite so clean, but it's basically, for a closed loop anyway, it's related to that in a certain way. However, in higher spin, this is not true. There's more numbers characterizing the thing. There's more invariant functions you can construct. And I think that's why it's important to do this, because this really picks up one of them. In SL2, I mean, basically anything, there's only so much information about the metric, yeah. But also this particular exponential form, e to the minus something times the proper distance, that only happens in the highest weight graph. Okay. Good. Okay, so now how do I do this? How do I evaluate the saddle point? So these are the equations of motion that come from varying that field U. Now, they look very simple. They're actually not. They're horrifyingly complicated. And the reason why you can't see it is because all the complication is hidden in this D. So D is a gauge covariant derivative. So the gauge field enters into this D. Now, I told you the answer is the same no matter what path I take. But depending on what path I take, the gauge field that actually appears here will look very different. And so if you take it like this, for example, it doesn't look too bad. If you take the wiggly line, it's obviously a horrible disaster. So these equations of motion are actually very, very complicated. And if you look at them, you do not immediately see a solution. Okay? So I'm going to do something that looks a little bit strange. In desperation, I'm going to try to find a simple solution. I'm going to try to say that, how about the following ansatz? What if the auxiliary field U does not change at all along the path? Okay? There is no reason for this to be a solution, but let's just try anyway. So if you stick this in here, what you find is that the equations of motion actually aren't empty because of these gauge fields that are lurking inside these covariant derivatives. And what you get at the end of the day is something that looks like this. It's kind of strange because in this formalism, x of s is just something that you fix. It's the path in the bulk. But nonetheless, I seem to have ended up with a differential equation for the path x of s. What this means is, if I choose my path to satisfy this differential equation, then u of s equals to 1 is actually a solution to the equations of motion.
What's t?
T, oh, that should be an s, excuse me. Thank you. That should be an s, I bet. Yeah.
So is this the geodesic equation then?
Good. If you write it in terms of things that are more normal, like the field minus spin connection, this is exactly the geodesic equation. Okay? Good guess. So this is kind of interesting. You see, this is, as far as I know, the only way to get the geodesic equation to come out from the Chern-Simons formulation. If you demand that you find a simple solution, life is really simple if you follow a geodesic in the bulk. Okay. So this is nice. This is what we wanted. And so while we could take any path to do this, a particular choice simplifies the problem a lot, the one that satisfies the geodesic equation in the bulk. And if you actually plug in the on-shell action, what you get is a simple thing that looks like this. Remember, a minus a bar is the Wheelbine, and so this is manifestly the proper distance with respect to the metric. Okay, so the metric has appeared, or at least the proper distance has appeared from the Chern-Simons formulation. So this is what I wanted to do, but it's nice that you can actually get this geometric thing out from this. Yeah.
So this was in a saddle point approximation to your path integral.
That's right, yeah.
So it's some approximation to your trace.
It is.
Now, is the root Takayanagi formula a similar approximation to the trace?
So I think that the root Takayanagi formula is also an approximation to a different, more complicated object. I don't think that the quantum corrections you get from including fluctuations of U really correspond to the quantum fluctuations about the root Takayanagi formula. I'm not sure that that's true. I think those are organized differently. Because it is my current guess. Because these fluctuations, if you think about it, this is precisely the action of a particle. So if you think about including these fluctuations, I think you'll reproduce the full propagator of the particle in the bulk, away from the large mass limit. I don't think that's what the Takayanagi formula is trying to approximate. I think it's a coincidence that it measures the proper distance, yeah. Well, maybe not, coincidence isn't quite right, maybe, but I think that the quantum corrections are not necessarily of the same sort, but I'm not really sure about that.
Well, there's a paper by Fong and somebody about that.
Yeah, there was, that's right.
It looked to me like the correction was essentially the entanglement entropy, which is not...
Yes, yes. That's right. So that's right. That's,
I guess if you're trying to extremalize the entanglement entropy, that's obviously very different from like quantum path integrating and
memory. Yeah, exactly. They seem to be different, yeah. You might wonder if there are other classes of corrections than the ones that they... For example, in this theory, there's no extra... They include the quantum fluctuations of the bulk fields. That's the entanglement entropy of those bulk fields. So there are no extra bulk fields like that, actually, in this theory. Because it's just pure 3D gravity. So that class of corrections doesn't obviously appear here, but you're right, the flavor seems wrong, basically, is I think the short answer to that question. Okay, good. And so so our prescription basically agrees with the Takayanagi formula because they both compute proper distance. And if you care about the prefactor, you can get that correct as well by appealing to the replica trick way of computing the entanglement entropy. You can get that to work out correctly as well. Yeah.
I'm confused about that. Why is it computing entanglement entropy and not something else?
Good, so you're right. I'm really only computing the proper distance, and there's a connection that has to be made between the proper distance and the entanglement entropy. Why are these two the same thing? And I think the sharpest way to see that is this paper by Lukowitz and Maldacena, where they argue that if you compute, do the replica trick, zoom in the
entropy.
I
understand this.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to understand is understand what the Wilson loop is.
That's right. Yeah.
Case, mm-hmm.
That's right. So there, if you wanted to implement their arguments in the Chern-Simons language, you would actually get this construction. You need some object to create the right sort of deficit in the bulk. This object does create the right kind of deficit. If you try to implement their arguments in this language, you get this. So that's another way to see it, perhaps. Okay, good. All right. Okay, so I spent quite a long time rederiving a very simple thing in using Chern-Simons theory. Okay, so let me just review what we just did. I reviewed how 3D Chern-Simons theory works and describes ADS-3 gravity. I proposed a specific choice of Wilson line that computes proper distances, and I argued this related to entanglement entropy. And then I computed the relevant trace in some saddle point limit, and I argued it does compute the proper distance. Okay, and the calculation is simple if the bulk path follows a geodesic, but the answer is the same for any bulk path you take. Okay, good. So this finishes spin 2 gravity, so now I'm going to move on to higher spin gravity. Okay. So because I don't have that much time, I'm going to talk about higher spin gravity in ADS-3 on one slide. Okay. So recall, this was the action for spin 2 gravity, where A was valued in SL2. What you do is you take that SL2 and make it into an SLn. And if you do that, you get a simple presentation of higher spin gravity in 3D.
SL2 has an entire representation.
So yeah.
How do we deal with that with SLn?
I think it still does. Let's see. I think we actually checked that the highest weight rep that we were dealing with for SL3 was unitary. I think that we checked that. Is there reason to believe that it does not? I think that it does.
Because SL2 has signature 2, 1.
Uh-huh.
The Keating form on the group. As for SLN, you have to be very careful about which real slice you pick, and you get more than one time, and then maybe you have closed time like curves, you usually don't get unitary representations.
Very good. Okay. That's interesting. So let's see. Good. So we did not worry about this, and that's the short answer, actually. So I should talk to you about this in detail, I think. You'll see that in the classical sorts of limits that we work, it's very hard to see how things like that actually appear, but if it's lurking in the background, that would be worrying. I think that there are field theories where this plays an important role, so I suspect that it is possible to find representations that are unitary for things that you want. But yeah, maybe it's something to worry about. I'll ask you about this later. Good.
You can only get higher spin in 3D this way?
In this way, yeah.
I mean, is there some analogous story in higher dimensions?
It looks much more complicated. And this business of truncating at any finite end is just different. You can't do that, as far as I know. You can't do that. So this is going to play. This is basically why this story will not generalize to any higher dimension, because
well,
this
also, the minus sign looks funny in higher dimensions.
Oh, this guy? I see. Right.
Bad,
well, let's see. I mean, here the minus sign is basically just telling you it's parity invariant. That's all that minus sign is saying. So I'm not sure that
well,
it's that.
Yeah, again, because it's sort of topological.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
You can't have runaways.
Right, all right. Yeah, you could worry about that. That's true. That's true, yeah. Yeah. No, that's a good point. Yeah. So I think most of what I say is not going to doesn't have any simple translation to higher dimensions. That's right. It really uses the 3D specific things in a very specific way. That's right. Okay. Good. Okay. So let me tell you why this is called a higher spin theory. The reason is that if you try to you can generalize write down a generalized Wheelbine A minus A bar, and you can now compute traces of this of A minus A bar. So previously you could only do this once. You could do trace of E squared. You got the metric G. Now, though, because these are larger matrices, you can take more and more powers of E, and you keep getting non-trivial fields. So for example, if it's SL3, you can take the trace of three powers of E. This has three indices, and so you get a spin 3 field, and so forth and so forth. Now, what I'm going to do is focus from now on the simplest case, which is SL3, just one extra spin 3 field. And that will already introduce some interesting new structures. Everything I say can actually be generalized without too much difficulty to any SLn you want. They just need to be very systematic. Okay. So now, I need to tell you a little bit about the structure of solutions to the higher spin gravity theory. It turns out that every embedding of SL2 into SL3, so different ways of choosing an SL2 subgroup inside SL3, gives you a different way to choose what you call the metric. And it's actually dual to a different CFT on the boundary. So there are two ways to do this for SL3. One of the ways is called the principal embedding. If you do that and you decompose various fields under this SL2 subgroup, you get a spin 2 field and a spin 3 field, okay? And that's fine. And this is called the principal embedding for some reason. And there's a relation between the central charge of the field theory and the bulk level of the Chern-Simons field. And this is the relation. Here's another way to do this, where you pick a different embedding of SL2 into SL3. That way is called the diagonal embedding because of the way the matrices fit inside each other. And you get a different relation between the bulk central charge, between the bulk Chern-Simons level and the boundary theory central charge. It's just a different number. And finally, there's one more thing about this I have to tell you. This theory, this vacuum is not unitary. By not unitary, I mean that this gauge field A in the bulk is dual to a current which generates a Kac-Moody algebra. The level of that Kac-Moody algebra is negative in this theory. And so the theory contains negative norm states. And so it's up to you how upset you want to be by this. I'm a little bit upset about it, and I'll explain why in a little while. Okay. Just keep this in mind. This theory is non-unitary. This one is fine, as far as I know. And like I said, the higher spin gauge symmetries act on these fields in a complicated way. In particular, this bulk metric is not gauge invariant. They're mixed together in a very complicated manner. Okay, so what about black holes? You can again have black holes in higher spin gravity. And again, in the Chern-Simons language, to characterize them, you do pretty much the same thing you did in the Chern-Simons theory in lower spin gravity. They're characterized by their defect, the type object in the bulk. They have a non-contractible phi cycle and a contractible Euclidean time cycle. Again, the holonomies around the phi cycle measure the charges of the black hole. They're bigger matrices now because the black holes have more charges. In addition to mass and angular momentum, they also can carry higher spin charges under these higher spin fields. But everything else is more or less the same. But the confusing thing about these black holes is that you can make their event horizon go away. The notion of event horizon is not gauge invariant, and you can move it around and make it go away completely. And so here, though, I can no longer just compute the metric and feel secure. Here, our usual notions of geometry have become messed up and confused. And like I said, we need a new way to organize our thinking about these theories. However, the construction of the Wilson line that we had previously generalizes completely naturally to higher spin theories of gravity. I just replace this R, the representation, from an SL2 one to an SL3 one. So my claim is that the Wilson line in the appropriate highest weight representation of SL3 is the generalization of the Ryu-Takinagi formula to higher spin theories of gravity. So this is a very natural generalization. And we had guessed this a long time ago, and we're working on this. Halfway through, this paper came out by Likowitz and Maldacena. And if you apply their ideas in the Chern-Simons language, you are actually led to pretty much this, I believe. So this is related to the replica trick approach of computation of entanglement entropy. I can talk to you more about that precise relation if you like. And finally, I should mention that there is a different proposal by a group in Amsterdam. They have a very different starting point. However, they do get the same final answers for a single interval on the boundary. So there's a different proposal, and they get the same answer, so perhaps they're not that different. Their proposal looks a little different when you apply it to a black hole. It's a little bit more complicated to get the answer, but it's a different starting point.
Does it give a different answer on the black hole?
So it's not precisely gauge invariant for closed loops. It's only gauge invariant under the diagonal subgroup, and so they have to do an extra step to figure out. Basically, that means the radius matters where you put it. They have to figure out what the right radius is. So I find that to not be great. I like that this actually just gives you the right thing independent of the radius.
So you have two intervals.
So for two intervals, you have to add something together, right, to get the right answer. Now why do you add something together? Well, in this way of doing it, I would say compute two Wilson loops, okay? In a saddle point approximation, you get exponentials of a product of exponentials, which is the same as adding something in the exponent. So then you can get that answer from here. In their one, they don't get the exponential of a large number times the answer, the prescription they use. So you have to add an extra ingredient telling you to sort of take a log of some intermediate step and then add the two logs together in a certain way. So again, I find this a little strange, but you know, I think that if you work with it, you can get it. I mean, the real truth is, again, in SL3 gravity, there's a couple of invariant objects. And if you have enough information, you can guess how to extract those invariant objects from the matrix you want. But this highest weight thing actually picks it out automatically. So that's why I think this is a reasonable thing to do.
So if you have any actual direct evidence for this, then it's more like you actually calculate the entangled entropy in some state?
Good. Yes. Let's get to that. Okay. All right. So good. So let's compute the entangled entropy in some state. Okay. So we did it the same way as before. So again, let me tell you how I take the trace. The trace works, basically everything works the same except that I promote the 2 to a 3 everywhere. Okay. So now my abstract auxiliary quantum mechanical system is a guy living on the SL3 group manifold. It's a little bit more complicated now because there are multiple Casimirs you have to choose to get the information. There's not only a quadratic Casimir, but also a cubic Casimir. The quadratic Casimir is chosen in the same way as before, which I didn't really tell you much about, but you can get it by worrying about the replica trick and the conical deficit. The cubic Casimir I set to 0. And the reason why I do this is because I want the bulk entangling surface to carry no higher spin charge. If it was not 0, it would source the higher spin fields in a more complicated way. And you can argue from various things, this is not what you want if you want to compute an ordinary vanilla entanglement entropy. Okay? So this, setting C3 to 0, is the analog of saying I'm generalizing something that doesn't couple or couples in the minimal possible way to the higher spin field. Okay? Okay, so now let's again search for solutions to that system. So something is actually different now. Something is different in higher spin theory. So again, the equations of motion look very similar if you write them down. So you might think we'll do the same trick as before. I'll set my field U to 1 and look and try to find some sort of generalized geodesic type equation. So this doesn't work. And the reason why it doesn't work is there was an interesting coincidence before. U was a guy living in SL2, and so it had 3 components. My path moves in ADS3, and so it has 3 components. And so it's kind of a coincidence that I managed to trade off the U dependence for the X dependence. Now, this equation looks exactly the same, but A now lives in the Lie algebra of SL3, and so this equation has 8 components and not 3. And no matter how I wiggle this field around, this path around, I cannot generically satisfy this equation if A and A bar live in any interesting way in the higher spin space. There are 8 equations and 3 variables, and if any of the higher spin fields are turned on, it overconstrains the system. So this trick that I had only works if we live only in an SL2 subgroup. Otherwise, we have to find solutions to this guy some other way. So I think this is kind of interesting that the sort of geometric interpretation that I had in the spin 2 case simply doesn't actually work here. I cannot find a privileged path in this way. This geodesic thing just isn't a useful idea in higher spin theory. I think this is fun. It leads us to the problem. It means that we can't solve this in the same manner. But it turns out there are tricks you can use to solve the equations, which you can do, and which I won't tell you about because it's just technical. So, okay. So now what are the answers? What do you get if you actually do this? So I'm going to discuss the results in order of increasing complexity. So you have, so first of all, I'm going to talk about the diagonal embedding. So remember, that was one of the embeddings. It was the one that I didn't like because it was non-unitary. Now, there are some bulks, there are some bulk fields, the spin 2 fields, some gauge fields, etc. So first of all, you can check and make sure that if you look at the ADS-3 vacuum with the BTZ black hole, everything works out like you expect it to. That's good. It's a lowest order check. Now, there's something non-trivial you can do here. You can turn on a holonomy for this gauge field around the black hole. You can turn on a U1 holonomy. Now, if you do that, it should not actually change anything, because this is a purely, it's the U1 gauge field is a Chern-Simons term. In the boundary theory, you're doing spectral flow on the states. You're not actually changing anything. You're just changing how things look. So it shouldn't actually change the answer. But from the higher spin point of view, actually, this is a non-trivial thing that you do, because now you've turned on some structure in the higher spin space. So the answer turns out to be exactly the same as you expect. But actually, the trick didn't work anymore. And different fields are turned on, but they cancel from the final answer in a way that you get the same answer. So this is actually a non-trivial check, even though it's not a very exciting one, because the answer is actually the same. Okay, but it passes this. OK, that's fine. So let's move on now to a slightly more interesting case. Let's look at the principal embedding. Okay. So here I have a spin 2 field and a spin 3 field. So the ADS-3 vacuum and BTZ black hole work out. OK, good. But now you can do something different. You can turn on a chemical potential for my spin 3 current. The spin 3 current is called W. So I'm going to deform my CFT Lagrangian by adding this chemical potential. So there's an important point to note here, which is that the deformation is irrelevant. Okay? So in the UV, it's dimension 3, because it's a spin 3 current. So in the UV, this deformation causes all kinds of bad things to happen. And you expect to lose all control over the theory. We'll return to this in a little while. But for now, let's just ask infrared questions, and hopefully this will not matter. So now what you can do is compute the entanglement entropy for a single interval on a black hole, which is charged under this higher spin current. OK, so you can do this. If you make the interval size very large, you get an answer which grows linearly with the length of the interval. That's what you expect from a black hole. So it's expected structure. But there's also a coefficient here which should measure the entropy density of the black hole. So there's a question you can ask, which is, does this coefficient match with the thermodynamic entropy of the black hole? You can calculate the thermodynamic entropy in other ways, and so you might hope that it would match. OK, the problem is there are too many ways to compute the entropy of this particular black hole, and so there are two answers in the literature at the moment. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about this controversy. There's something I'm going to call the UCLA entropy, after the people who derived it. This was derived, the people who first wrote down this black hole solution at UCLA, they did the bulk thermodynamics in a way which seemed very sensible, and they got an answer for the entropy. And there have since then been a couple of calculations backing this up. In particular, you can do them in the CFT in a different symmetry algebra, but one which is supposed to reduce to this one in as you take a certain parameter to n, or to 3 in this case. So there are some CFT calculations that back up this entropy. This is a solid entropy. On the other hand, you can do something different, which is that you can try to expand your fields in a metric type formulation. You can expand in powers of the higher spin fields. And if you do that, you can sort of expand perturbatively and write down a Ricci, like a Ricci scalar in higher order terms. And you can then use the normal technology of the Wald entropy to derive an answer. If you do that, which you can only do perturbatively, you get a different answer from this entropy. And since then, various people have shown how you can recover a nonlinear generalization of that answer, so an entropy which reduces to that in the perturbative limit, using the bulk Chern-Simons thermodynamics. So, and it's different from this thermodynamics. Okay, and so there are two different answers. And so what does ours do? Well, ours can at best agree only with one of them. It turns out to agree with this one, okay? Which is, I guess, the best we could hope for. Now, it's not the best that some of us hope for. But but this is what happens. Okay, so now what's going on? So I believe what's happening is that there are multiple consistent notions of energy in the boundary theory. And hence, because these are derived by using DES, TDS, they're pretty different first laws. There are various papers which claim, would say that they have resolved this. I don't really understand actually all of them, so this is a little bit confusing to me at the moment. So our prescription, of course, doesn't actually know about any of this. It's completely rigid. There is no way that I can tell to modify our prescription to get this answer. So this is interesting because ours really comes from a different starting point. And so this remains to be sorted out, but I think there's a resolution to this story. Okay. It does agree with one of the ways of computing the bulk thermodynamic entropy. It's a bit of a relief. Okay, good. So now there's one more case that I want to talk about, which is this following story. So remember I told you the chemical potential is irrelevant. Okay. And so in the UV, the theory, we should be losing all control over the UV theory. However, actually, what happens is, in the UV, it turns out to flow to the other vacuum of this bulk gravity theory. This did not need to happen, but it does happen. Okay? It flows to diagonal embedding vacuum. Now, here's the RG flow. Okay? So if you look at this at zero temperature, thus this solution is an RG flow from the diagonal to the principal embedding. So here's the RG flow. I've written down the central charges. If you look at them, you might be a little bit upset, because this goes the wrong way. The central charge is less than that one. So this is weird. And there's a conflict with common sense, but there's no real conflict with any theorems, because the deformation breaks Lorentz invariance, and the theory is not unitary anyway. So this is not in contradiction with any theorems, but it's a little bit odd anyway. So the question you can ask now, if you compute entanglement entropy on this background, what do you find? Okay, here's the answer. It looks pretty bad, actually. So let me tell you about what happens. There's a particular kink at intermediate length scales, okay, right here. This is an intermediate length scale which relates to the scale of the deformation. Relatedly, this guy actually violates the strong subadditivity of entanglement entropy. So let me tell you how to see that. For one interval in an infinite system, strong subadditivity tells you two things. It tells you the entanglement entropy must always increase, and furthermore, it must always be concave down. So it ceases to increase here, as you can see, close to the kink. It also it's concave down in both halves, but the kink is kind of a singular violation of the concave downedness. And so there's a little bit of violation of strong subadditivity right here.
Why is there such a abrupt kink?
Good. So what is from the sharpness of the kink? It's quite interesting. The sharpness of the kink comes from the UV cutoff of the theory. The UV cutoff manifests itself in some sort of awkward way at intermediate length scales. And so if I wanted to explain why that happened, remember the central charge is bigger in the IR. The way in which this theory does that is it singularly injects a bunch of degrees of freedom right here at this kink. Okay? And sort of the number of degrees of freedom depends on what the UV cutoff was of the original UV theory. But that's where this kink is coming from. It's trying to make that happen and inject a bunch of degrees of freedom so that the final central charge can be large. So it's that's related to this wrongness of the sign.
There's a very precise point at which the theory becomes non-unitary.
That's maybe one way to look at this. Yeah. So I find this somewhat perplexing. Actually, I'm not sure how to interpret this. You could just say that because the theory is non-unitary, one shouldn't stress too hard about the UV part of this picture, because it's at least reassuring that the IR part of this picture is fine where the theory is unitary. But I'm not exactly sure what this means, to be honest. And we are performing calculations on related backgrounds to try to understand this better. Okay, good. So there are many fun things to do with this formalism. So there's some concrete things, which are that there are many theories of gravity that have Trehn-Simons descriptions. You can try to understand them. So this gives a new way to probe such theories, and you can try to, in particular, understand entanglement entropies in these theories. For example, topologically massive gravity is one thing that we're working on. You can study different higher spin backgrounds. And so that's a concrete direction, but a sort of more philosophical one is higher spin theories of gravity are more solvable. They are dual to things which are more solvable. And one might hope that if you could push this further to a theory which we really have a lot of control, you could maybe understand more concretely how entanglement in the boundary is encoded in various bulk fields. And so that's the ultimate goal of this program. Okay, so let me just summarize. I explained how the Ryu-Takayanagi formula relates bulk-induced entanglement entropy. I reformulated that using Trehn-Simons' theory in higher spin gravity. And it still remains to be seen what this actually tells us about the emergence of geometry from field theory. Thank you.
Lessons do you expect to extract about dynamical gravity, about higher, say, more dimensional?
From this program? So if we could do this for the 4D theories of higher spin theory, I think you could probably learn a fair amount. But this particular program really uses the structure of 3D gravity in great detail. So yeah. So this Wilson line type construction will not actually be helpful for 4D gravity. That's right. So I still hope to learn something. I think the structure of 3D gravity, how entanglement entropy emerges, you do learn things about how geometry works with as related to field theory. But whether or not you have perturbative excitations around that does not seem to be enormously important for the emergence of using it to compute entanglement entropy. So I think you can still get something useful about this thing, independent of whether you have bulk dynamical degrees of freedom or not. But I don't think this program itself will tell you that much about dynamical gravity, or the aspects that are specific to having gravitons that wiggle in the bulk. That's right.
Just dimensionally, you need a two-dimensional
Yeah.
surface operator.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is, so
That is, yeah. That's right. I don't know what it is.
Well, but surface operators have shown up in these formulations of Litton and Company, in some sense, put a field theory on a surface and integrate it out, and then that gives us an effective surface operator. But that's not the same thing as computing entanglement entropy that seems to be.
Well, you would need to do that in a Vasiliev, in the Vasiliev theory, at least in the bulk. So I think that even that obvious operation isn't that obvious how you would do that.
All right, well, let's thank you again.